Hello, everybody. Hope you're doing well. It's Steph. I'd like to start off the show by thanking the gentleman in North Carolina who spelt my name wrong on a very nice check, which I really do hugely appreciate. And I'm just going to say he says, oops, your name is spelt wrong on the check. I hope that's not going to be trouble. Let me know if it is. Now, let me start again by saying thanks. Hopefully, the check says that as well. Indeed, it does. Thank you so much. Your podcasts have been immensely insightful to me and have pushed me forward in my growth and quest for personal freedom and liberty. I am your biggest determinist fan. Please don't hold that against me. Hey, baby, if determinism gets me that check, I'm all over it. Free will be damned. I wholeheartedly understand your reasonings for its rejection, but that is not something that would keep me from learning from you and your past experiences. Who knows? Maybe one day I'll believe in free will again. I would like very much to receive any and all materials that you can send me to aid me further. Please keep up the positive attitude towards all of those who don't quite get it yet. I hope to continue supporting in the future, so please keep going with the big ideas and plans. I also have many friends who have converted that I'm confident for believing that their support for you will be forthcoming. Please let me know if this letter finds you well, and I expect to be high on the donors list for any organs or firstborn children that I may need in the future. Sincerely, name. P.S. I would love to tell you my story one day. It may be beneficial to helping others to come out of the darkness of religion and statism. Absolutely, my brother. You tell me your story. My Skype name is Stefan Underbar Molyneux. Let me spell that for you, since it was a challenge. Stefan Underbar Molyneux. Just get Skype on your computer and give me a pingle, and we'll chat, baby. So thank you so much. It absolutely is great. I just dropped quite a lot of money on advertising, so this is good for food and, of course, more advertising. So thank you, thank you, thank you again so much. And if you have, if you want to send me a check, easy peasy, 979 Pine Valley Circle. Pine Valley is two words. Mississauga, MISSISSAUGA, Ontario, Canada. L as in Larry, 5 W as in Walter, 1 Z as in Zebra, 2. And my name's on the way. Just throwing some stuff in which they'll have to edit out for future generations of these podcasts since I'll be long dead. So, thank you again so much, and I look forward to your donations. If you don't want to use your Visa or you don't want to use your PayPal account, then just send me the cash. I really, really appreciate it. And of course, my friend, send me your login name for the board, and you will have access to, oh gosh, quite a number of premium podcasts by now, as well as a private section of the board, which is the first place I go to answer questions. So, I'll check for, I don't think I'll get it by your name, but just send me your login name, and I will set you up. And, of course, I will send me your email, and I will send you novels and books aplenty. So, all right, let's have a look at, this is going to be a two-podcaster, I'll break them up. The first one is related to the question of DROs as governments. And I know that this may seem like old topics for long-time listeners and an odd place to have this, but I think it's worthwhile because what I'm trying to do at this point in the podcast series is not deal with old topics, but to give you better tools for communicating old topics. So I'll give you another. I mean, if you've got the truth, right, then any way you approach it is going to get you there as long as you're logical, right? So if you need to get to the number 4, there's a near infinity of ways to get to the number 4, right? 2 plus 2, 6 take 6 minus 2, 4 divided by 1, 20 divided by 5. Like, there's a whole bunch of ways that you can get there as long as you're logical and consistent. And the more varied your arsenal, so to speak, the more you will be able to drag people kicking and screaming to the simple light. So, this person has written this and on the board. A very intelligent person. I do feel that a little bit that we keep having the same conversation over and over again. So I made some suggestions that he perhaps didn't take the right way, or perhaps I didn't communicate them the right way. But his question was this. How would education work within a DRO system? All the situations I've considered, the educational system ends up multi-tiered. Such a lack of standardization could make the system non-beneficial for those caught at the lower extremes. I'm not saying that this does not already happen, but by using standard curriculum and some government finances to help those on the lower part of the existing spectrum, then the effect is reduced somewhat. At least this is what the UK government has told me. Well, There is, of course, an egalitarian horror of what is called multi-tiered, and multi-tiered just means that there are different offerings of quality based on price. We know this with computers, right? You can get a 486 for like $15, right? Or you can get the computer that I got for Free Domain Radio, which was, $2,700. So you can go through the whole spectrum of quality, right? I mean, so food ranges from, I don't know, McDonald's to haute cuisine. So there's an entire spectrum of multi-tiered offerings that are available in a free market. And there are a couple of sort of important or key considerations to understand about what this multi-tiered situation means in the free market. First of all, the price in a free market almost always tends to go down. I mean, there'll be particular scarcities, right? So I don't know, there's a mine collapse in copper, the price of copper will spike, thus drawing more people in to want to produce copper, which then drives the price down even more. But if you look at sort of 19th century America, the prices went down about 50% over the course of a century, because there was not a whack load of government intervention and so on. So the important thing to understand is that the multi-tiered system, what it is, you think of price, think of like a waterfall as a series of steps, right? And price is the water. It just constantly trickles down. So when you think about, the very first computers, the IBM monster, big, deep thought tonnage machines of the 1950s, they cost like millions and millions of dollars. And so you'd look at that and you'd say, well, computing needs, I mean, again, taking the same sort of approach, you'd say, well, computing needs to be subsidized so that poor people can get these multi-tonnage machines in their basement. But that, of course, is not what happens or is productive in the real world, right? If you start subsidizing computers when computers cost $1 million, what happens is you just keep the price up, right? You just keep the price up, right? So if somehow there was a bunch of socialist people who said, well, let's not go shoe nuts, let's just say computers were all $10,000, and the government decided to subsidize the purchase of computers for everyone in their home. Well, all that happens is that you make sure that computers never get better and cheaper. Never. You actually stall the productivity of computers. Right? Because if people can sell their computers based on a subsidized rate of $10,000 a computer, or $100,000 or $1 million or whatever, there's no incentive to improve quality or reduce price. You simply freeze the development of computers at whatever time frame you implement the subsidy or the outright sort of government purchase. There is a little bit of patience that is required that freedom brings that is hard for people. Right? So if you can't sleep at night because poor people don't have computers, and you can't wait for 10 years or 20 years for computers to come down in price and to increase in usability, right? Then you're going to naturally be drawn, if you're sort of amoral or don't understand the basic ethics of it, to feel that the government should provide subsidized computers to the poor, right? But it's disastrous. It's completely disastrous because, again, you freeze the technological development, and you see this over and over again, that the technological development just gets completely frozen when the good gets subsidized. So what happens is you get these big, bulky, awkward computers delivered to the poor that are not user-friendly. Because you don't have to make them user-friendly because your market is not the poor, your market is the government. And the government's already paying you, so why would you invest money in R&D to make these things more user-friendly if you're already selling them, right? Quality is voluntarism. There's no other way to get quality, and even that doesn't always guarantee quality, but quality is voluntarism. Also, what happens, of course, is that, I mean, there is no free lunch, right? I mean, so you subsidize these computers, and again, education you can substitute for computers, still a little easier to work with computers. Conceptually, there's no free lunch. What happens, of course, is that by subsidizing these computers at $10,000, you cause an excess of materials and labor to be consumed in the production of these computers, which the poor may or may not want, may or may not use. We don't know. We do know that they're not willing to pay the 10 grand for it. We do know that, we know at some point people would buy a computer, right? At some price, people will buy a computer. If a computer is a penny, and you can sell it for 100 bucks, people will buy a computer, right? So we know that the price is not 10 grand. The price is going to be somewhere, but by subsidizing it and handing it out at 10 grand, what happens is that you get an enormous amount of resources shifted towards the production of computers, which draws resources and labor and materials and capital away from other areas. Which means what? Which means the prices of goods in other areas goes up, naturally, right? I mean, just think of if silicon is used in five industries and then the government starts subsidizing computers, then obviously the price in the other four industries for silicon is going to go up, which means that the prices... There is no free lunch. You get a subsidized computer, you just pay more in other areas. Of course, the taxes required to pay for them get drawn out of job creation and so on, so there's fewer goods available for the poor in other areas, and digital watches remain very expensive. You know, you get the whole idea. I don't think we have to go over that in basics here, but... The same thing, of course, is true of education, right? As soon as you subsidize education, it gets frozen in time, which is why, you know, while everything else that is in the free market has radically changed over the past 100 years, or 130, 140 years, since the government began subsidizing public education, right, everything gets frozen in time. At the moment you subsidize something, it gets frozen in time. So this is why, 140 years after the institution of public education, you still have the same ridiculous setup, where you have a teacher with a chalkboard and 2 months off in the summer. Madness! Absolute madness! And yet, that, of course, is what happens. You subsidize something, all of the efficiency principles go out the window, and you get stagnation and resistance to change rather than... Violence fundamentally alters people's relationships with each other. Fundamentally alters their creativity. It fundamentally alters their innovative desires. So this is, of course, why you end up with the situation where education is mired in a form that may have been even somewhat valid 130 years ago, but it's completely ridiculous now. So, the key thing, of course, if we take the metaphor of computers, the key thing is not that poor people have a computer in their house. Right? The key thing is not just that poor people get a computer delivered to their house, which they put in the basement, or they sell, or sits there unused because they don't understand it and don't really care about it. And we know that because they certainly wouldn't pay the 10 grand for it, right? So it's current incarnation. It's not going to be that helpful. But all government can do is lead the horse to water. It can't make it drink. All government can do is deliver computers to poor people. It can't make those poor people want to use those computers. And even if it makes those poor people want to use those computers, it can't make them want to use them in a way that's going to be economically productive. Right? This is all very, very important. If I deliver some computer to, I don't know, a bunch of poor people, maybe their kids just use it to play video games, which actually harms their economic chances in a way. I mean, if they say, well, I'm not going to get a job because I enjoy playing these video games, or I'm not going to study because these video games are so cool, or whatever, right? You can't guarantee. All you can do is deliver the computer, force people to make it and then deliver it, or compel people to pay to make it by forcing other people to pay for it, provide the incentive for people to make it. But you can't make it economically productive, right? And you will guarantee that computers will never get better, never get more user-friendly, and therefore that the odds or the opportunities for them to become economically productive don't increase, right? So if you subsidize computers when they're 10 grand a pop and you deliver them all to poor people, you never get the internet, you never get email, you never get a GUI, a graphical user interface. You never get increased speeds. It never becomes more valuable. Right now, that you can buy a used computer for 50 or 100 bucks and get an internet connection for 10 or 20 bucks a month, wealth of knowledge, instant and free communication. Now, it's economically valuable for poor people if they want to get a computer. Easy to use, easy to set up. It has value-added things like free phone calls and so on, right? So, you can't make that happen with force. All you can do is deliver a big, kludgy computer that's hard to use and has little value to the individual family, to people. You can't make them use it. You can't make it more valuable. And in fact, you're guaranteeing that it will never become more valuable in the future because you're freezing it in time by applying force. So this is really, really important to understand in terms of education. All the government can do is force children to show up at school. And it can force them to stay back if they don't pass certain tests. But that's like saying all you can do is deliver a computer to a poor family, and then you can punish children who don't pass basic tests on how to use a computer. Right? That's still not making it economically productive. It's still not awakening a desire in them to learn about computers. It's still not making the computers more efficient. If you want poor people to have computers, you need to deregulate the computer industry as hugely and as much and as greatly and as deeply and as widely as possible. That is the only way to get computers into the hands of poor people so that poor people can gain the benefits. You have to deregulate it to make the price drop down. You can't raise people to the price by subsidies. You can only have the price lower to the point where it becomes economically advantageous for people to buy computers. Economically means doesn't mean that they're making money off those computers, but they want to buy it, right? They'll invest in learning it, right? If you hand out MP3 players to everyone on the planet, how many of those will become like really avid at using and learning and understanding MP3 players? 10%? 20%? Again, assuming they even have digital music, right? You don't know. So in terms of education, the only thing that you can do to get education, quality, valuable education into the hands of poor people is to take the compulsion out of it, take the gun out of the room. Right? That's the only conceivable way that you can do it. Does that mean that for the first generation, right? Because the metaphor here becomes tricky, right? So I'm saying, well, when computers are $10,000, you privatize the industry, and then, you know, 5 or 10 years later, computers become something that people can afford. Well, no, right? I mean, that's not exactly the same with education. What you do, of course, is by privatizing education, you make the value of education then has to match, because education is an investment that pays off in terms of income, right? We'll just say in terms of income, forget about sort of quality of life and so on. Education is an investment that pays off. So the challenge is with people who can't afford a lot of education, initially, how are you going to make it pay off? Well, there's tons of ways to do it, right? You know, distance learning, educational learning, e-learning, mail correspondence courses, podcasts, for instance, free videos on the web, or education that is more focused and is subsidized in return for, you know, if it costs $20,000 to get an accounting degree, but it bumps your salary up by $20,000 a year, people will be falling all over themselves to subsidize accounting degrees. Perhaps not art history degrees, but that's not the end of the world, right? Hobbies should not be subsidized. Nothing should be, but hobbies in particular. People will be falling all over themselves to subsidize degrees for people that have economic value. You know, the same reason that people are falling all over themselves to lend you money to buy a house if you are, if you've got a history of repaying your debts, right? Because they're profit, right? $20,000 to get a university, an accounting degree, which bumps your salary by $20,000 a year, escalating over your life. It's a massively great investment. There's almost no better investment than education. So they'll get it, right? The incentive is simply to reduce the cost of education and to provide as much value as humanly possible. And that's just in the capitalist sphere of profit. But of course, profit is a complicated term, which also includes the good feeling which comes from philanthropy. I'm going to give you another metaphor. Well, let's talk about philanthropy. Then I'll give you another metaphor or way of explaining it. Philanthropy, of course, is the desire to give out. It's the good feeling that comes from, and happiness, of course, is the goal, right? Lots of people get happy from generosity, philanthropy, charity, and so on. And so, of course, if you care about education for the poor, then you'll donate some money to the poor. Will you donate $50 a week or $50 a month to, well, of course you will, right? And people already do this for, those sad-eyed kids in Africa, right? So, of course there'll be generosity, there'll be, right? Right, I mean, that's inevitable, right? But let's have a look at sort of another metaphor, right? If there is something which is essential for people, which is multi-tiered and that's unacceptable, then, of course, food is far more essential to people than education. You can live without education, you cannot live without food, right? So, of course, food is what the government should take over first, right? Again, I'm not saying that anyone on the board wants public education. I'm just saying that if you're debating with somebody who does, right, and you say, okay, well, food is obviously more essential than education. Can we understand that, right? Yeah, of course, right? So, clearly, if you're for public education, then you must be for public food production, government food production, right? And, of course, we know, having seen the effects in Russia and China and Cambodia and other places where public ownership of the means of production with regards to food, what you get is starvation, which is directly analogous to what happens to kids' brains in public schools, right? They're starved of stimulation and rationality, joy, hope, excitement about learning. Right? They're just taught to be tape recording droners, right? Play back what the teacher said, you will get an A. So if we look at the analogous situation in food production, we'd look at Russia during the great Ukrainian famine of the 1930s, when like 10 million people starved to death, right? And you'd say, well, when there's public education, when there's public food production, government runs the food production, what we get is a whole bunch of people starving and a few people who have a good amount to eat. It's like what O'Brien says to Winston Smith in The Inner Party. He talks about the red wine. Sorry, not too much of this gets to the outer party members. Right? So the inner party have all the food in the world, but the vast majority of people are starving. And that, of course, is the situation when it comes to education. It's exactly the same as food production in under the Soviet system. The principles are the same. So in a situation where basically everyone is living off like thin cabbage soup with fish heads and bugs in it, where in a book called Wild Swans I read years ago, a woman describes that her parents were eating the stuffing out of their pillows, and they were eating like ropes of garlic strands and stuff, just anything that could conceivably have any kind of food in it. They were just eating, and then they died. People eating their own babies, literally. I swear to God, it's ghastly, but it's real, and it happened. So, in that situation, where people are literally starving to death, and someone comes along and says, gee, maybe we should turn the food production over to the private sector. And then people say, well, I don't know, because then there'll be a multi-tiered system. You say, well, what's a multi-tiered system? It's like, well, some people will only be able to eat at, like, Subway or the Pita Pit or, I don't know, maybe even McDonald's or whatever, right? Whereas other people will get haute cuisine. Be able to eat at, like, North 44 here in Toronto, which is where I proposed to Christina, by the way. Great restaurant. Where the meals are, like, entrees are $50. And that's bad. Well, compared to what? Right, is it bad to only be able to eat out at Subway and have like a fresh, nice sub with meat and so on for like a couple of bucks versus starving to death, eating your babies, or, if you don't want to go that far, just eating thin cabbage soup with fish heads and bugs in it and barely having enough calories to keep body and soul together? That's the comparator. The single tier of starvation, or a multi-tiered system where even the lowest tier is far higher than the enforced tier in the current system. Your average homeless guy gets far more calories in a system of even quasi-private food production such as we have now. He gets far more calories than the average Russian did under the Soviet system, public food production. The only tier that you can enforce is universal near starvation and private, quote, plenty for the elites. And of course, that's what we have in education now, right? So the very rich people can send their kids to private school because they can afford to pay both the taxes for the public schools and for the private schools. Private schools are heavily regulated, can't become more efficient than the public schools. So those are your options. Universal starvation and an embarrassing plenty for the minority, or a tiered system. So what you're basically saying is to the people who are living on 800 to 1,000 calories a day, sometimes while even being laborers, who will eat anything they can get their hands on or have to live on thin cabbage soup with fish heads and bugs, you're saying to those people, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to live with this situation because I'm concerned that in a free society, some of you might have to shop at low-rent grocery stores. Right? You would be mobbed and killed. Right? You go to people in a Soviet gulag, right, in the 1960s or whatever, who are living on a couple of hundred, maybe a thousand calories a day if they're lucky, who just spend their entire time discussing food because they're obsessed with it, because all they can do is think about food. And just, again, listen to or read the Gulag Archipelago for this, descriptions of this. They're so hungry that when they find prehistoric fish frozen in ice, they eat it raw. They don't care, right? Because they're just dying of hunger. So you're going to these Soviet gulags in the 1970s where people are literally starving to death on their feet. And you're saying, well, you guys are going to have to stay the way you are because I'm concerned that in the future, you might, your children might have to, or you might have to shop at grimy grocery stores. I mean, they'd lynch you. Who wouldn't? I mean, that's madly insulting to say to people, you must starve to death because I'm concerned about an inequality of food distribution in the future, though even the lowest tier of that food distribution in the future will be far, far higher than where you are now. Look at the American South. A lack of food is not a problem for the poor. Lack of education about food, maybe, but lack of food, not so much. And this is the situation that you're really dealing with, like when you get right down to the nitty-gritty of it. Right? This is the situation that you're really supporting and dealing with in the present. You're saying to these kids who are stuck in these nightmarish public schools, where their brains are turned to mush, where in a lot of those schools there's bullying, there's violence, there's just mindless, stupid, dumb rules and repetitive, boring tasks and frustration, alienation, enforced idiocy, where their brains are rotting from the stem up. And you're saying to these kids, I'm sorry, you're going to have to stay here because in the future, the schools that will still be far better, even the worst schools in a private system will be far better than the best public schools. I guarantee that. The worst grocery store in a free market is better than the best grocery store in a Soviet system, and I mean those available to the public. You're saying to these kids, sorry, you're going to have to stay in this rat hole, gulag, brain-killing machine, because I'm concerned that in the future, your kids might get slightly less or even considerably less decent an education than the very richest. It's like saying, sorry, you have to continue to eat thin cabbage soup, bugs, and feathers, and prehistoric fish, because in the future, I'm concerned that you will only be able to buy tinned spaghetti and not real spaghetti. And of course, the answer that comes back is, well, who the hell are you to make that choice for me? Again, not sort of accusing anyone on the board, I'm just sort of pointing out that this would be the logical response. Who are you to tell me that I have to stay in this place because you're concerned about how education might be or might not be provided in the future? Why do I have to stay in this intellectual, filthy rat hole because of your emotional concerns about education in the future? Right? We talked recently about how unjust, this is also in my book, how unjust it is to use other people to manage your own anxiety. It's totally wrong. It's abusive. It's destructive. It's inhumane. So, if you feel uncomfortable with a variety of educational choices being offered in the future, that's your business. That's your emotional anxiety to manage. If you feel uncomfortable, that's your business. You don't get to keep people locked in the prisons of state schools. You don't get to destroy the minds of children at the point of a gun or advocate that because you feel uncomfortable about a potential inegalitarianism in the future. That's your emotional issue to deal with. You don't solve that by keeping people locked down. You don't get to advocate the starvation of people in the present because you're concerned that in the future there's going to be a multi-tiered distribution of food. That's not anybody's issue to deal with but yours. If you're uncomfortable with freedom, that's an emotional issue that you need to deal with personally. That is not something that you deal with by advocating state education. And if you want the poor to get a great education, then go be a teacher and work for free. Or make a lot of money and donate it to a school. Or go to a therapist and deal with the emotional issues you have with regards to egalitarianism or a hierarchical structure in society. Those are emotional issues to deal with. You don't get to use the gun of the state to keep people down because you're concerned about a multi-tiered society. I mean, this is exactly the same as a racist saying, well, we need slavery fundamentally because I need to feel superior as a white guy. It's like, hey, if you've got insecurity issues about race or whatever, that's your issue to deal with. You don't deal with that issue by enslaving blacks. You deal with that issue as a personal, emotional issue. And again, I'm not attacking anyone on the board here. I'm just sort of saying that if you're debating with people like this, you feel uncomfortable with a hierarchical society, that's an emotional issue. That's an emotional issue. If my wife decides to go and get a job and I'm all hung up on being a patriarch who provides and so and so and so, is it just to deal with my anxiety by locking her in the basement? No! No! Is it just to deal with our anxieties about a hierarchical or multi-tiered society by locking children in these brain-deadening gulags? No! You know where else there's a hierarchy? The marriage market, the dating market. We all know this. Go to the meat markets, go online, look at the pictures, see who gets the most responses. It's the pretty folk. Right? Do we deal with that? Oh, I'm not sure that the homely people are getting dates. Do we deal with that by forcing dates on people? No, that's your anxiety. You don't get to pick up a gun because you feel anxious. Right, that's the trait of, frankly, a sociopath, which is far more common, I think, than we anticipate or expect. And here's the last thing that I'll sort of say about this, but that last bit is really, really important. When you feel anxiety about, we're all trained to feel anxiety about these things, right? Ooh, how will the poor get healthcare? How will the poor get education? We're trained to feel anxiety about this through emotional intimidation and the equation of not caring about these things or wanting these things to be settled by free interactions. by being told that that's a bad person, right? So we're just made to feel anxious about this, and then, of course, we're supposed to support the use of the gun to settle our anxiety. Like any hair-trigger wife-beater, we're supposed to use violence to control our own anxiety. So really think about that. It's not... You don't get to lock children in public schools because you feel anxious about a multi-tiered society. But here's the funniest thing of all. I mean, for me, again, this is just, to me, it's quite funny. I hope this makes sense. So, here's an example. This is a post. This is a gentleman who said, "I just listened to your podcast about poverty. I think it was like number 60 or maybe a bit earlier. I completely agree that majority of adult poor are either there by choice or by fault of their own. But in your discussion about the deserving poor, you brought up children of the undeserving poor. In the private capitalistic free market where schooling costs money of the parents, how are these children handled? Do they not go to school and so stay poor their whole life? Through no fault of their own? How would we help the deserving poor children without subsidized schools?" I mean, this is how far we are from applying theory to the real world, right? I mean, this is funny to me. I mean, fundamentally, and I don't mean this with any disrespect, because it is hard to remember this and to just sort of understand this. I get this question so often, either on the board or in my email, from people who've listened to dozens or hundreds of free educational podcasts about history and philosophy and art and science and psychology and relationships and dream analysis and this and that and the other. Free! All of it free! And they say, well, how will poor people be educated in a free society? Do you see just how astounding a question that is fundamentally? I mean, just simmer yourself into that question, into that perspective for a moment, just for a moment. If you've listened to 100 podcasts, and this question always comes from people who haven't donated, and that's nonetheless, right? That's again, that their own lack of generosity or lack of reciprocity is what they project onto society as a whole, and then they claim to be concerned about the poor, right? But it's fundamentally, absolutely hilarious to me. And again, no disrespect, it's hard to see, right? Once you get it, you really get it. It's so funny. People say, "I've listened to 100 of your podcasts, Steph," which is like 75 hours or whatever, of totally free, at your leisure, whenever you want, no obligation education. Totally free. Totally free. I don't require a single penny. Yeah, you got to have a computer, but literally, computers are nothing, right, these days. But all of this, and I'll be perfectly honest with you, I want to be the best educational resource on the internet. I want to be the best podcast, the most educational, informative, instructive, illuminating, entertaining podcast. I'm shooting for the moon, baby. All the way to the top. Too funny for words. If you don't get it yet, just hang in there, right? Because it's completely hilarious. So it's like this. It's like I have this free buffet that feeds whoever they want, whoever wants it. I will mail them a free meal every single day. 3 meals a day, 5 meals a day of the best quality food that you can get. Right? And the people who subscribe to this service, who get their 3 meals a day of incredibly high-quality food, totally free. Tens of thousands of people I send free meals to every day. No obligation, no contract. You don't have to pay a penny. You don't have to lift a finger. Free. Delivered. Meals, meals, meals. High-quality meals. The best meals around. And all these people stuff themselves on my food. And they're so full, and their food is so rich, they have to slow down their intake because it's so good. The best food they've ever tasted, totally free. And then what they do is they call me up, they burp because they're so full of this incredible high-quality free food, and they say, well, yeah, Steph, but how are poor people going to be fed in a free society? Burp. Oh, my God. Oh, I swear to God, if you people could see how this looks, it is too funny for words. Thanks for the free food. I really appreciate it. Best food I've ever tasted. But I still have no idea how people are going to be fed in a free society. The best food that I've ever eaten is free. But I'm concerned that people without money aren't going to get high-quality food. Oh, my God. You know, I can't even laugh at it. It's too funny. I can't even laugh at it. It's too funny. And this is directly analogous. Look, people tell me quite regularly that this is the most educational stuff that they've ever had, ever gotten from anyone, and it's free. And then the next email is, but how will poor people be educated in a free society? Right, this is the cost, though, of not being generous, right? And frankly, there's a kind of hypocrisy in this. And again, I'm assuming that you're not like a starving student or whatever, right? In which case, like, eat, drink, be merry, right? Free podcast, educate yourself, fantastic, right? Pay me back when you can. The reason, and this is why I say donate, 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 not for me, although I certainly appreciate it, but because what it gives you is certainty. Because what it allows you to do is to not be hypocritical. Right? By hypocritical, I don't mean that you don't donate or anything like that. And this is not about donations. This is about you and certainty and happiness. Let's say that you're concerned about free education for those who can't get education. Fuck the free society 100 years in the future. Forget that. We're talking about right now. Right now. Right now. Right here. Are you concerned about getting quality education to people who can't afford it? Then give a little money to Free Domain Radio. What do? I get to advertise. I get to get the word out to more people. I get to afford more bandwidth for more downloads. I get to spend less time on business planning and how to raise revenue and more time on actually delivering quality podcasts. I get to do, once I get the money together, I get to do the introduction to economics. I get to write the next book. I get to do all of these things. Right? This is what is so hard for people to understand about philosophy and how it's supposed to actually have an impact on you and help you make decisions in the real world right now. Nobody's talking about a free society in the future where poor kids may not get educated. Nobody's getting educated now. And you can do a lot to change that. Right? Fuck the fucking free society, anarcho-capitalist stand in the future. To hell with that. What are you doing to help the poor get educated now? If you raise I mean, this is so funny. It's so fundamentally funny. And it's not, again, I'm not sort of trying to blame anybody in the here and now. I'm just saying this is the degree to which we're so badly instructed about values and living. If you are concerned about the education of people who can't afford a good education, but have never donated to Free Domain Radio and have listened to dozens or hundreds of podcasts, then you're talking through your mother effing ass, frankly. Because if you actually cared, actually cared about educating the poor or those who can't afford an education, you'd donate. Maybe, and if there's a better educational resource out there that's given a better education for free to the poor or whoever, fantastic. Go donate to them. I'm not talking about money for me. I'm talking about integrity with what you claim to be concerned about. I mean, it's so funny. The people who have asked me these questions are almost invariably the people who've never donated. Which is why I know it's got nothing to do with care or concern about the education of the poor. It's just, it's anxiety. Right? It's anxiety. You feel emotionally anxious about a multi-tiered society. Why? Because you were told it was a bad thing, because maybe you don't feel like you can cut it, or maybe this, you know, if you recognize a hierarchical society, you have to have hierarchies within your own values, which is going to have some cost to your personal relationships. I don't know. I'm not psychic. But I do know that it's got nothing to do with any kind of real-world concern for the poor. Nothing! Because if you're concerned about educating those who can't afford it, and you've never donated a penny to Free Domain Radio, or whatever other institution works for you, then of course you're not concerned about the poor. Come on. I'm not an idiot. Especially if you yourself are consuming the resources and finding them incredibly valuable and educational. Man. I mean, this is the analogy, and it's hilarious. Right? It's hilarious. Like, here's the analogy, right? You're saying people are stuffing themselves at my buffet with the best quality food that they've ever had, so they tell me. And they say, wow, you know, thanks for that free meal. I never could have afforded this. And by the way, not only is it free, but it's the best food I've ever had. The most nutritious, the best tasting. And you say, but how on earth are you going to help feed the poor in a free society? Thank you for all this free, incredibly great food. I'm stuffed to the gills. I couldn't be happier. I'm healthier than I've ever been. But how on earth are you going to educate people in a poor society? Or educate poor people in a free society? And I say, well, you could donate a few bucks to help me get more food out to poor people. No. I don't want to do that. But this is how philosophy works, people. This is how values and ethics works. Or doesn't in this case, right? But this is the complete disconnect, right? I'm handing out all this free food to poor people. Poor people, students and so on, are stuffing themselves to the gills. And they say, well, yeah, but how are you going to get free food to poor people? And I say, well, you're eating, aren't you? Well, yeah, but how are you going to get free food to more poor people? Oh, you could donate 20 bucks or 50 bucks. Oh, no, I don't want to do that. And that's fine. By all means, eat at my table. Don't pay. I can live with that. I really can. I don't begrudge that. If you can't afford it. Even if you can afford it, it doesn't bother me that much if you don't donate. But if you don't donate to spread free education to the poor, then don't talk to me about how concerned you are about getting free education to the poor. It's madness. Madness. And inevitable, right? I mean, this is what happens when you don't live by your values, is you assume that those values will never be acted on by someone else. Well, I don't give to the poor because I don't really care about them, so how will the poor be given to? Well, not everyone is like you. Not everyone is like you. Some of us do give to the poor. Some of us take massive salary cuts and give up entire careers to give to the poor. And I'm not saying that I'm altruistic or not benefiting in this. It's the best life ever. But don't talk to me about how you care about education for the poor. If you won't give 20 bucks, I mean, to help spread... I mean, come on. When you get free education and you don't help subsidize anybody else, then you have no reason or right to worry about how the poor get educated in the future. Anyway, I think I've made my point. Perhaps more than once, as usual. So thank you so much for listening. Dare I say it? Yes! I do dare. I look forward to your donations. Bye.